Well, let me tell you, we started 106 new companies in the last 3 years, 43 in the last year. Approximately 200 new jobs were created, and these companies raised about $125 million in funding. So we're extremely active. We're ranked number 4 nationwide for startup creation.
Welcome to Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew. Millard Chan and Andrew Moss launched this podcast to give a voice to the countless founders, angel investors, incubators, supporters, and startup events located in San Diego.
Welcome back to another episode of Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew. Mill, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Andrew. How you doing, man?
I'm not bad. We had a busy couple of weeks there. We were doing recording live from Quick Pitch. Well, not live, but we were talking to the presenters and had some really good people on.
I really liked the way the organizers did it this year at Quick Pitch 2017. In previous years, the 10 finalists would actually sit in the audience and they're all just looking up at the stage. But this year they switched it up so they were put in the back in the green room area in a room adjacent to us doing the podcast recording. And what I really saw were the finalist entrepreneurs and founders were all talking to each other, giving each other support, and just commiserating together as a group, which was amazing.
Yeah, they were very supportive of each other. And the other thing I noticed, it was interesting to see how they all prepared for going out on stage in front of 500 people. And some decided to be more social and stick around and talk to each other. And some wanted to be by themselves and sort of just psyching themselves up. It was just interesting to see everyone's different way of preparing for the presentation.
So we look forward to getting that episode edited and then out to you all shortly. Andrew and I are so stoked to be joined by Dr. Devora Rossi, who is Senior Manager of Innovation and Commercialization at the University of California, San Diego, Office of Innovation and Commercialization. Previously, Dr. Rossi was responsible for sales and distribution in Latin America for Affymetrics. Prior to that, she was Vice President for Business Development at eBioscience, an Affymetrics company, where she was responsible for mostly corporate and business development transactions. Devora, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So if I could just tell a little story. So we met a long time ago, about 12 years ago, when I just moved into town, and we were both taking a course at UC San Diego Extension called Biobusiness. Interestingly enough, I haven't confirmed this, Devora, but I believe Dr. Michael Lutz is teaching that again.
Correct. I saw him the other day, and he's starting again the course.
Yeah, it's just so amazing that, you know, for listeners, if you ever, you know, get into a situation, we get to know people, it's really interesting how we actually haven't seen each other in person in 12 years.
Right.
But we've corresponded over the years by, email and such.
LinkedIn.
I know back when there were job openings at the company I worked for, I would send it out to you. Do you know anybody? And then vice versa. It's just so interesting that, you know, you go through something together, in that case, a really awesome course, Biobusiness.
Right.
And to be able to kind of keep connected, even if only electronically, over the years.
Yeah, that was great.
So you've been working in life sciences at the industrial and academic level for over 20 years. What made you choose to pursue this career?
Well, I love science since I'm a kid. I knew I wanted to be a biologist when I was 13 years old. A lot of my friends were taking tests, you know, vocational tests. And I said, how come they don't know? Because I had it so clear. I think my dad helped in the decision too, because he was an MD. And he always said to me, oh, you know, biology is more fun than doing medicine. And you have the possibility of going abroad, living in other places, learning a lot of new things before, you know, something, before the medicine is developing, therapy. So though he loved being a doctor, but he always supported me tremendously.
So it's interesting. In this particular case, you had the apparent modeling, you know, behavior in an industry, in this case, the medicine,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, because, you know, you always hear about boys and girls, boys pink, boys blue, girls pink. They do certain things related to their gender being pushed in that way. But it's really great that for your situation, you're exposed to the sciences early on so that anything is possible.
Of course, yeah. Okay.
And do you find that a PhD is necessary if you want to work in life sciences?
Not really. It depends on what you want to do. It really depends. So if you're going to be, if you know from the beginning when you're doing a bachelor and you already know that you're going to be business, it may not be necessary to go all the way to PhD. I suggest that you go to be, you know, you go all the way to a bachelor or an MS. If you want, you can do a PhD. But I must say, though, that in my experience in different companies in the past, I've seen a difference between CEOs that know science and CEOs that don't. And the key is when you're in a room, the CEO has a bunch of VPs, marketing, business development, sales, etc. And, you know, everybody has its agenda. So if you have a CEO that understands the science, the project in depth, he or she can make a decision based on what he or she knows and not so much what just the VPs are telling him or his team is telling him. So I notice a huge difference because I've seen sometimes teams trying to sell stuff and say, nah, no, that's not gonna fly. And because the CEO was super, super knowledgeable. So the problem is hard nowadays. I think it's getting better, but it used to be very hard to find someone with scientific knowledge plus the people skills and the business skills. So whoever has those three, believe me, will have a job.
Were you on the PhD track back when you were an undergraduate? Did you always know you would go to graduate school?
No, I didn't know. I said, oh, PhD, what's that? Oh, okay, great, I'll do a PhD. And so I went to Spain to do it with a scholarship, which that was great. And then I knew I never wanted really to be a professor in a lab. I'm really more practical and applied. And I thought that I would probably be better in business, in biotech. Initially, you're doing R&D in a biotech, but later on, once you're in the business, so in the biotech world, I found that, I cannot just be a scientist. Being a scientist is great, but I have other options. It's not that either I do that or, you know, I'm done. And one of the things that are keys in the U.S., you have the possibility of just not following a specific track.
You said one of the benefits in the U.S. as opposed to where? In Latin America?
As opposed to Latin America or Europe, you know, it's harder. People say, okay, you know, do you have an MBA? Well, maybe we can think of putting you in business. Always asking for a degree or a lot of experience. They never want to take a chance on anybody. So that's why I like the U.S. It's more dynamic. And they give people chances to move around. And, if you know, that's what makes it so great here.
Yeah, that's coming from an immigrant, folks.
Yes.
You know, immigrants are important. Great perspective. So we'll get into the transition between the R&D side to business in just a moment. But one thing that's worth reflecting on a little bit is, based on my experience, if you're on the molecular biology or the chemistry side, so the science side, it's so important to have the PhD if you are in industry, right? Because from what I recall, it's very difficult to rise up above, say, a research associate or maybe associate scientist without the PhD.
Yes, if you're going to stay in science. That's why I said if you know from the get-go that you're going to go into business or statistics or, I don't know, clinical trials, monitor or what, if you're going sideways from pure research in a biotech, then you don't need a PhD. But if you're going to really stay in research in a biotech or a pharma, yes, you need a PhD if you want to go all the way up. I agree with you.
And interestingly enough, if you're on the engineering side, that's not required. So scientists, they're looking for PhDs to rise to the senior and management levels. But on engineering, bachelor's totally fine. It's like, as long as you can build it, they'll give you the responsibilities. So interesting.
It's interesting, yeah.
So when did you know that you wanted to move from the bench side to the business side? What was the earliest opportunity to kind of spark that interest in you?
I was in the Bay Area in the Dynax Research Institute in Palo Alto, and I was doing research. But although I loved it, I didn't see myself for some reason just staying in the lab. I think I'm a very social person. I have good interpersonal skills, and I need also that. I mean, I feed off the energy of people. So being a little bit too much isolated in the lab wasn't for me in the end. And so I thought that, okay, you know, moving to business is something that initially I thought marketing. I took a certificate of marketing at UC Berkeley Extension. But then I thought, you know, I was trying to find jobs in marketing and so on. And nothing came up. And an opportunity then appeared to do more business development. And I said, well, I'm going to try it. And I loved it. I never left it after that.
That's actually interesting for our listeners as well, because we had originally talked about meeting at an extension course by our business, and then you also took an extension course at UC Berkeley, that it's not necessary if you're on the bench R&D side, whether it's science or engineering, to have to go through, say, a full MBA degree to get that learning, get that knowledge to go on the business side. It could be simply one course you do in the evenings or maybe on-the-job projects.
Correct, correct.
Good for people to know about those alternative options.
In fact, when I got my first job, which was at BD Biosciences, it was like associate program manager or something like that. And one of the things that got me into the door was the fact that I had a certificate of marketing completed.
That's amazing.
Because they said, oh, you know, she has a PhD, but she already, you know, took a further step to move outside of her comfort zone and learn something. So with that, they say, well, you know, she has... we're going to give her a chance. And they did. And it was a great experience. Learn a lot.
Awesome. And what does your role at UCSD entail?
So basically, I'm one of the senior managers. So what we do is we receive inventions from the scientists, and we determine whether these are worth patenting or patentable. And if we proceed to file a patent application, then our marketing rep and myself also, at least in my cases, try to promote the invention to potential licensees. And it could be via email contacts we have, LinkedIn, through partnering events that we attend, conferences like the BioConvention, networking events, etc. And if we find a potential licensee, then we start negotiations and hopefully we sign a license agreement. I also want to mention that many technologies are licensed by startup companies, which are founded by professors, by staff, or sometimes students at UC San Diego. And we try to promote this option heavily.
So I have been a licensee at UC San Diego in the past, and it hasn't always been a smooth or easy experience. So What I would love to know is now, it used to be called the Tech Transfer Office, and now it's the Office of Innovation and Commercialization. What's been the big changes?
Well,
aside from bringing you aboard.
No, I'm not. Well, I think a year and a half or two ago, they brought new people, new leadership. Paul Robin, who's the Associate Vice Chancellor of Research Affairs. Ruben Flores, who's the Director of the Office. And then more people like me that follow them. So I think the big change is the fact that, you know, we want to make an impact in the local economy. We want to make sure that we start as many companies as possible and license the technologies out. The fact that many of us in the office had both experience in companies and now in academia, or some had both from before.
That's huge.
That's huge, because then you have the view of what a licensor and the licensee needs. So, you know, but also the fact is, you know, UC San Diego is a public university and you have a lot of policies and regulations because it's a public entity and, you know, receives tax money. And that's some of the things I've been learning at UC San Diego. So, you know, sometimes you're limited, not because you just want to be difficult. It's because there are laws that say, well, if this is funds coming from NIH, tax money, blah, blah, there are some things you can do, some things you cannot do. So you're tied up. So, you know, that's something like Stanford, MIT don't have to deal with because they're private universities. And although they have regulations, it's all private money. So they have much more flexibility.
So there's all aspects of technology licensing that have to be unpacked. And some things you can change, some things you can't change, right? But I remember back in the day, the typical method was we list all our IP, all our patents on the website, and you, industry professional, just peruse the website and select something. We'd be happy to license it for you. And if you're an industry professional, number one, how do you even know to go look there at UC San Diego as an example? And number two, you don't even have time to do that. Mm-hmm. And so my thinking always was, you've got these PIs, so primary investigators that are key opinion leaders, they're experts in their fields, they're well known. They should be the ones identifying, or you select the top group of them, and they should be able to identify potential licensees in the field. And then the tech transfer office either sets up meetings or arranges some sort of event to kind of bring potential licensees and the PIs together along with the tech transfer office to make it so that they're actively doing something as opposed to kind of sitting there waiting for the licensees to come, because it's just overwhelming to do that.
Correct. No, we have a marketing person, and not only he writes course descriptions of technology and so on, he actively tries to approach desired companies. I mean, desired companies, by that I mean licensees that could be interested in the technology you want to promote. And so he actively engages with them. In my case, as a manager, I also do the same with my technologies. And so I go through LinkedIn, of course, a simple Google search, and try to find contacts. Or we work with each other. Do you have a contact at this company? Because I think they would be a good licensee. And we, you know, send them information and try to move the licensing, the license forward. Sometimes happens, sometimes not. One of the problems we have, I think, is most of the technologies are very early stage. So large companies, they say, oh, no, call me when you're in phase one, in phase two. And we do have some technologies or some therapies that are in phase one, but it's not the majority of it. So that's the main issue, no? It's the valley of death, because this is the early stage and you have to find someone who's willing to take a chance and move it forward. So,
or as you mentioned before, the PIs themselves. There's plenty of other universities out there that are super active in spinning off startups from the universities. Stanford's an example, Harvard, MIT, so many of them. And so if UC San Diego can become more active in that area.
Oh, we are. Let me tell you, we started 106 new companies in the last 3 years, 43 in the last year.
Wonderful.
Approximately 200 new jobs were created. And these companies raised about $125 million in funding. So we're extremely active. We're ranked number 4 nationwide for startup creation.
What?
Yes, wow. Based on...
That's news to me. That's awesome.
Based on a Milliken report. And if you count all the companies started associated with UCSD since 1988, we have 760 plus. So we've been particularly more active in the last few years, as I said. But and we also are working with, you know, trying to streamline the process of licensing. So I'm trying to be as flexible as possible with companies and with the professors. We organize tons of events. And there's not only us, then I don't know if you want to talk about later about all the resources we have. We have in San Diego, I'm not talking just UC. There are tons of groups that a person who's thinking, a student could be, him thinking to start a company.
Yeah, we'd love to hear about some of them.
Can work with. So some of the groups is we have the San Diego Venture Group. So they do events, they do pitching contests. It's an excellent place to network with others. But the most important
The San Diego Venture Group and Mike Krenn and his team joined together with Tech Coast Angels to
put on the quick pitch this year.
Exactly. Correct, the one you were mentioning before. But also, the new apart from connecting you to also venture funds, not only Tech Coast Angels, I mean angels in general, they have recently established an office in downtown San Francisco. And so if you're a startup and you need funding, I mean, you have a management team, you already have some angel funding, you know, you're at a certain stage, you can contact them and they help you organize your travel to San Francisco and put you in touch and make appointments with different venture funds. In the Bay Area.
So does most of the funds that you said, the 125 that were, you know, that has been raised in funding, is that mainly through venture groups, or what? Do you have a kind of a breakdown on that? Or
I don't.
No, not to worry. Just curious.
No, I don't have.
What you were describing before was kind of a startup funding concierge service from San Diego Venture Group. That's what it sounds like.
Yes. It's amazing. And they also, you know, have a ton of networking events, trainings. You have also Biocom, of course, that organizes, again, events, connects you with investors, develop public policy, helps in many ways when you're starting a life science company. So it's good to check them out on their website and try to contact them. They're an excellent source. Connect, don't forget Connect, is another group, offers tons of services. free of charge office hours for, you know, with lawyers, advice, again, events, training, amazing. We have in UC San Diego also, we have a bunch. This year we're like very exhausted because we organized so many events, the whole office. We all work together, you know, everybody gets different projects, but we all have to organize tons of events. We bring very reputable law firms to come and talk about different topics. You know, what do you see or what you should see in a term sheet? How do you structure a corporation? Should it be an LLC? Should it be a C Corp, an S Corp? The pros and cons of each.
So these things that UC San Diego puts on, is it only available to UC San Diego students?
No, that's open to the community.
To the community.
And usually have law firms that, you know, they come, they talk, even they sponsor or a networking event afterwards or a lunch. Also, it's also a networking event. But my point is we open it to everybody. It's for everybody. So the other thing I want to mention is, I don't know if you're aware of the San Diego Innovation Council. It's the San Diego Innovation Council. Yeah, it's an institution. Has been created recently and includes several institutions from San Diego that have joined forces to create a larger impact in the biotech world. No? And so these are San Diego State University, Connect, SPAWORD, Biocom, J. Craig Venture Institute, J. Labs, Biolabs, Ibonexus, Salk Institute, Sanford Burnham Previs Institute, San Diego Regional EDC, World Trade Center San Diego, Cleantech San Diego, Porto San Diego, San Diego Public Library, San Diego Regional Energy Innovation Network. And so, you know, the goal is to provide entrepreneurial activities, education, support commercialization, investment, and new company formation.
Okay, folks, so Devorah gave a lot of possible support resources and organizations around the San Diego region that you could tap into for support, whether it's funding, whether it's advice on legal matters, financial matters, et cetera. There's a lot of resource out there and you should tap them.
Yes, there's so many events. We did last year at the university. I didn't organize it, but I helped, but I didn't organize it. It's called Ignite, and we had around 1,500 registrants, including Baja California. So a lot of people from Baja that came. And we're planning the same for this year. Brianna in our office is the advocate, startup advocate, and she's spearheading this effort. That is her project. And she was telling me today that, you know, she's planning to have, it's going to happen in March, March 6 and 7, and she's going to have 3 keynote speakers, 2 pitch competitions, a startup fair with demo tables, international online investor demos, interactive workshops, expert office hours, special theme sessions, networking, and more. And we have a site called ignite.ucsd.edu, so you can go and check out the event. It was very successful last year, so we expect it to be.
I actually attended a few of the sessions, and I really enjoyed the experience. Thought it was very helpful. So in life sciences, technology licensing is just such an important aspect mm-hmm. to that industry. And so, you know, a number of our listeners are actually life science entrepreneurs. And since you've been on both sides of the table, both as a licensee and as a licensor, I would love to kind of get, you know, some tips on how do you get to a deal close? What are the terms that are just simply the biggest contentious issues between a licensor and a licensee kind of make their life easier?
Well, you know, I noticed lately from the licensor side, I mean, not both sides. You know, I noticed that when doing license agreements, many of our potential licensees said, well, you know, I want to have the right to keep sub-licensing rights after the license is terminated, for example. And that's one issue because a university needs to have the option at its discretion to terminate the agreement if needed. I mean, of course, we don't want to terminate sub-licensee. Why would we? But you have certain rules. Like, for example, if that sub-licensee is in a lawsuit with university, you know, more chances are that we're not going to continue that sub-license. The other, it's export control rules. I mean, as you know, we cannot do business in many countries, North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, and that list keeps changing. And so if we, you know, we need to have the option, because that list changes also, we have need to have the option to say, well, if the sub-licensee is in a country where we cannot do business, we're a public institution, we cannot do it. So that's one of the things I've seen sometimes back and forth, that the licensee doesn't understand it. And I think in this case for the university, it's reasonable. So we try to work around that.
Let me ask you a question. For deals that you've been a part of, mm-hmm. Tavor, do you find it's more common for negotiations to be done in person or virtually via phone call or email? And do you have a preference for one or the other in terms of getting to a deal?
I think if you're local, it's great to have a face-to-face. Why not? I think
100% agreed.
You know, nothing nothing replaces face-to-face interactions, I think. So I would recommend that if it's possible.
I would totally be in agreement with that, because too many times if you have this barrier of, you know, the phone connection or the internet connection, you cast the other side as the enemy. But I feel that if you get in the same room with all parties, you view them as people, as opposed to institutions or organizations. And people want to do business with people. People may not necessarily want to do business with a particular organization.
Correct.
Right? It's a people business.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. Totally right. Yes, I would suggest that first, face-to-face overall. Then use the phone. You know, if it's a long distance, you can use phone or Skype or whatever you need. But nothing really replaces it. So, yes. And sometimes, you know, and then sometimes if it's small deals and things are moving along, you can do it by email. Larger deals, I think you should definitely do or have at least one face-to-face.
Do you find upfront payments, upfront license fees or royalty rates or minimums particularly contentious during negotiations?
Well, of course, there always are. You know, sometimes it's the upfront, sometimes the royalties. It depends on the situation, on the technology, on the stage of the company that is trying to license the technology. They have cash. If they not, then maybe they want to give equity instead of, you know, an upfront fee, which is possible.
What are the things that an entrepreneur can do to kind of make life easier for them when negotiating a license?
Say it again?
To make life easier for the entrepreneur when they're trying to license from university. What can they do?
What can they do? Well, you know, I usually try to do a term sheet, go through each, the key items. So I make sure that, you know, we negotiate those key elements. And I think that helps. Sometimes it takes longer with a term sheet, but once you have, you know, you negotiate those, then, you know, moving into a license agreement, goes more smoothly. I think that
I completely
helps.
Agree with that as well. So for those that don't have much experience in technology licensing, oftentimes if you're inexperienced, people will bring in lawyers way earlier than they really should have. So it really should be you as the entrepreneur working together with the licensing officer of the organization you're trying to license from and hashing out the big business terms in what you described before, Devorah, mm-hmm. as the term sheet. And so once all the big business issues have been agreed upon, you then hand that to a lawyer to turn that into legalese, into a proper contract, right?
Correct. And sometimes I find myself, because the company sometimes still doesn't have a CEO, I have to negotiate terms with a lawyer directly. But to be honest, the lawyer also goes to whoever is the founder and starts, you know, and discuss this information. So I mean, there's no one size fits all.
Yeah, I would just say if you're an entrepreneur and you need to license technology, go and sit down with the tech transfer officer or whatever organization you're trying to get obtain technology from. I know a lot of times you think, oh, if I sit down in front of them, I'll be exposed, I'll be vulnerable, I may say something I may not want to say. Therefore, you want your lawyers to be there to shield you. But a lot of times when you're dealing people to people, you could talk about matters and understand what the other side really cares about, what you really care about, and then come to an agreement without getting into bringing in lawyers too early. Lawyers are very, very important because they help to manage your risk.
Correct.
But if you need to acquire technology for doing business and for development, that's something that should be considered too.
From your experience, how can a life science CEO best position themselves for sale of their company? When is the best time for them to sell?
I was thinking, sell when your company's hot, but that's an easy answer. So
that's not a trivial response, not a trivial response at all. There's many instances where, at least from an angel investor perspective, they'd rather sell early rather than later. Whereas if you have, say, VCs come in and they need a certain multiple, they'll keep you in there until they're satisfied they get the returns they require.
Yeah, but sometimes you may get those and sometimes you may not. Absolutely. So in any case, what suggestion can I give is position your company by being either the leader, the second or third leader at the most in the market, but at a particular niche. Because if your company is not very focused, it makes it harder to sell. And why is that? Because you need to look at it from the buyer's point of view. So if a buyer needs your company to become a leader in a niche, but you have four other product lines. So, and these other product lines, yeah, they bring some revenue, but it's more a distraction than anything. And so then the issue is that the buyer says, well, I'm going to pay X amount, but I really want this product line or this project, which is really key. And, you know, it's strategically fits perfectly in my company, but I don't want your other four product lines. Who cares? And then usually the seller says, well, you know, I took time creating these product lines. I have revenue, blah, blah, blah. Well, I don't want, you know, you need to pay for this.
Right.
But the buyer doesn't see the value. So I think one of the things you have to be very careful what projects you decide to pursue. So you make sure if your exit strategy is to sell the company, then it's better to be focused than be too diversified.
That's interesting. That's a very, very good point. You know, one of the benefits of having a diverse product line is more opportunities to generate revenue. But if the path to liquidity event is an acquisition and really buyers in the market focus on one of your product lines, that's something to consider as well.
Yeah. I know it's kind of hard to know what's going to be the hot project or the hot area years from now. So today we know what they are, but then in 5-6 years, you don't know. So I know it's a difficult bet, but
you know, I would actually call in the example that you gave, Devorah, I would call the bluff or the buyer of the acquirer. I would say, okay, I've got four product lines. You're interested in one of them. Fine, you buy one of them. I retain the rights to the other three.
Oh yes.
Because if you say you don't care about it, then you shouldn't ask for all four in the deal when you only care about one, right?
Yes, yeah. You can. Definitely, you can. See, but sometimes the seller wants to get rid of everything.
Yeah.
Wants to move on, do something else, retire, who knows? And they may not want to keep the others. That's one of the one piece of advice I could come up with. Also, when you run a company, try to run it almost as a public company. Initially, when I was, I remember Ibai, I said, oh, we're run as a public company. Why? We have the freedom. We are privately funded, blah, blah. But it's true that then, you know, we had, when your books are audited, you know, by reputable firms, or Ernst & Young or one of those, then, you know, that's one of the things the seller comes and they say, well, show me your books, you know. And so you want to make sure they're audited in good shape. And so, you know, they feel more comfortable in what they're getting into. So that's something you have to keep in mind.
That's great. Are there any funny, horrible, or otherwise memorable stories you can tell about technology licensing or acquisition?
Well, I do remember a couple of agreements in the past when I was in previous jobs, and I negotiated an agreement, an OEM agreement, supply agreement, with a company, and I sent them the final agreement for signature, and this company said to me, you know, I didn't receive it back. And I said, So I was following up, calling them up, sending them emails. Hey, you know, I sent you the agreement. I haven't seen the fully executed copy yet. What is it? Oh, it's coming. you know, 2 weeks, oh, it's coming, 1 month, oh, it's coming, you know, until it never came. So it was really surprising to me that they didn't have the you know, the decency to come and say, you know what, things have changed, I'm sorry, we tried to do this, but we're not going to pursue it. And, you know, I'm not going to be happy, but it is what it is. You're going to force anybody. But just to disappear in the night and tell you and lie to you and say they're going to do it, you know, then I thought, well, I guess I'm never going to do another agreement with these people.
Exactly. I mean, I've heard of ghosting on dating apps, but ghosting in a business negotiation, it's not professional.
Well, the other one I had was I negotiated an agreement with a foreign company and for months. And then I sent it for signature again, and they wouldn't sign it. So they were just, but they didn't wait that long. So they went. They waited for 30 days, and then they came back, and they said, well, you know, we really don't like the terms, so we want to start all over. And I said, no, I'm sorry. And they wanted everything for free, basically, our time, our resources. And I said, well, I'm sorry. I think we already negotiated on this number of months. And if that's what you want, maybe you should go somewhere else. But I wish you the best. I mean, it wasn't in a bad relationship, you know, in a bad terms. But, you know, that was really strange. I mean, you're at the point of signing and then...
It was really just a waste of everyone's time, it sounds
exactly.
like.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I was really mad. Oh, well, live and learn.
So many stories like that.
As we wrap up the episode, what's the best way for people to reach out to you? What's your social media game?
Okay, so my social media game is usually LinkedIn. I have Facebook, but I'm using it less and less and less, and particularly I try to use it more for personal life and less for business, so I prefer to use LinkedIn. And then also, you know, I'm at UCSD, so you can contact me at my email address, which is D as in Deborah, Rossi, all one word, at ucsd.edu. Our website, which is innovation.ucsd.edu, has a lot of information, links to events. I suggest you really go into it. Check the San Diego Innovation Council. Check all the groups I mentioned. And I'm sorry if I forgot some, because there are tons of websites and associations that help out. The SBA, the Small Business Administration. I personally organized with a team in UC San Diego the SBIR tour, where the program managers from the SBA in Washington came, and they spent a whole day here. They met met one on one with people who are trying to submit proposals for SBIRs, and we got 200 people. So go to the website, and not only ours but others, and then check all this. It's way too many events. I try to go to all of them, or not to all of them, but many of them. But I need to work too. So
okay, so you can hit us up at Twitter at Startup Talk Pod. Hit me up personally at Millard Y. Chan. Check out our website, StartupTalkPodcast.com. Email us if you like, StartupTalkPodcast@gmail.com. If you like this episode and you really enjoyed the conversation that we had with Devorah, please share it with your friends and family on iTunes or wherever they listen to podcasts. Devorah, thank you so much for joining us today and having a conversation.
No, thank you for inviting me. It was great.
That wraps up another episode of Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew.
Let's get started. Hey folks, please subscribe to Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew on iTunes and rate and review us. It helps other people find this podcast. This episode was produced by Millard Chan and Andrew Moss. Our sound editor is Lee Liang. Additional voices from Mindy Nguyen. Our theme music is Good Times by Puddington Bear from soundofpicture.com. Our podcast Sherpa is Charles Wilchett.